Good afternoon. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. It's Friday, March 8th. We have a number of bills that we were hoping to hear at another time, but things change around here pretty quickly. So I'm sorry if the delays or the change in schedule has created problems for you. But I appreciate your patience with us and your willingness to come and meet with us today. A quorum is present, and so we can begin with Senate File 632, Senator Benson. Do you have any amendments at this time, Senator Benson?
No, Madam Chair, and thank you for accommodating this hearing. I'm not going to offer any amendments in the committee. We'll talk about the bill as presented. Senate File 632 addresses the extension of newborn hearing screening and the retention, or the Newborn Hearing Screening Committee, and the retention of data associated with the newborn hearing screenings. This committee's primary jurisdiction is the committee, and so I'd ask us to focus on that work. The second part of the bill refers to data collection, and while first committee can always ask about those issues, there is work that needs to be done before we get to judiciary. So I can answer questions, but I'm not going to be making changes. I'm not going to be making those significant changes in this committee. The advisory committee was created in 2007 when a newborn screening mandate was passed. Minnesota was the last, or the bottom five of all the states in its screening and reporting to the Centers for Disease Control. Studies show that if babies are screened at birth and have confirmation of their hearing loss by 3 months, they receive early intervention services by 6 months, they can reach typical developmental, linguistic, social, and emotional milestones. If they are not screened and test and the hearing loss found, they will experience delays. Some are very difficult to overcome. We have to remember that hearing screening is through the use of equipment. It is not the collection of genetic material. And when my two older sons were born, they didn't do the hearing screening. But when Claire was born, it's really a simple test. The baby lays in the bassinet. They put small plugs in each ear, and they run through a series of tests. You can watch the screen, and you stand there, and you wait for the nurse to tell you that the results are either within the normal range or that there is something that your baby might need help with. And so it was a wonderful experience for me to have this information early on and know a little bit more about what I could expect about my baby's development. As I said before, the second part of this information does relate to data. We will be going to judiciary. There's been significant conversation already about the data provisions in this bill. We're not ready to make those changes, but I can stand for questions on that issue as well. I'm going to ask my testifiers to go ahead if it's okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, please. We have Mary Hartnett. Are you going to begin?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mary is the Executive Director in the, of the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Mary Hartnett. In addition to being the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing, and for new members, we are a non-cabinet state agency that advocates for and with people that are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing to develop public policy solutions to barriers faced in education, healthcare, employment, technology, and access to public services. And as Senator Benson mentioned, in 2007, Minnesota was in the bottom five of states in the reporting of hearing screening to the Department of Health on the results of newborn hearing screening. And we conducted a survey with hospitals and asked why, you know, the results were so low. And we found that because there was not a mandate, they did what they were mandated to do. And when they could, they did the hearing screening. So the commission led a coalition of organizations, many of them that are listed in Senate File 632, and we developed a system. And it wasn't just getting a hearing screening mandate passed, but we used information from the Joint Commission on Infant Hearing and used evidence-based practices and put them into a complete system. So you see in front of you the bills that we were able to get passed. In addition to the newborn hearing screening, We were able to get parent-to-parent guides who provide support and information to families. And Senator Sharon, you were the chief author of that bill in 2007. You were part of one of the champions that helped create this infrastructure, this floor for families once their baby is identified with hearing loss. And then we were also able to get deaf mentors that provide sign language to families immediately upon identification. We were able to get, for a small number of families, we were able to get a hearing aid loaner bank, so there's immediate access to amplification once the baby is identified with hearing loss. And then coordination within the Department of Ed for special ed services. And with that, we created a wonderful system that's supportive and is overseen by the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Advisory Committee. This is a system that's being built out, and there's still more work that needs to be done. You see in front of you the report from 2011 of the great work that's been done. The biggest progress that we've made is that we have gone from being in the bottom five to the top five in our screening in the country. We have gone from 81% of babies being screened to 99.1%. But there's still a lot of more work that needs to be done. And we have here today to explain some of the work and why it's important to continue to have the advisory committee continue until 2019. Linda Murrens from the Children's Hospitals and Clinics.
Thank you, Ms. Murrens. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Murrens. I'm a pediatric audiologist at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. I'm a former chair and have been a member of the Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee since its inception in 2007. I want to thank Senator Benson for introducing Senate File 632, which extends and allows the committee to do its work for another 6 years. The Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee is comprised of diverse stakeholders that provide guidance to the Minnesota Department of Health and for newborn hearing screening. We're representatives of Minnesota state agencies and programs, organizations that represent families of children with hearing loss, people that are deaf and hard of hearing, medical, educational, and social service providers. Our work is accomplished through collaboration and partnerships. You have before you a report. This is the 2011 Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee report. And the committee sets early hearing detection and intervention goals, indicators, and benchmarks. This information is based on national goals, program objectives, and performance measures for the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Tracking and Surveillance System from the Center for Disease Control, the CDC. Minnesota was late, as Mary said, in its passage of the newborn hearing screening mandate. We need to continue to track and build out the system. Newborn hearing screening processes are still evolving. We are identifying babies earlier as a result of the newborn hearing screening mandate. In fact, I just identified a three-week-old with hearing loss yesterday. On the other hand, I identified a five-year-old with hearing loss earlier this week. Some are still falling through the cracks. Our committee measures not only the number of babies screened at birth, but how many parents follow through with a referral, get a diagnostic evaluation, and get into early intervention services. It's a process. We have work groups that develop protocols for pediatric audiologists, primary care providers, and otolaryngologists. We ask that you approve the extension of the life of the committee so we can continue to improve our newborn hearing screening and early intervention system. We need to continue to work to make it better and to ensure that children are screened, make it to diagnostics, receive early intervention by 6 months of age. It has to be early, so that they can achieve developmental milestones of their typical hearing peers. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Murrens. Appreciate that. We have another testifier, Twyla Brace. There you are. I couldn't see you at first, Twyla. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and identify your representation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we have been involved in the newborn screening issue area for a long time and have looked at this bill and talked with Senator Benson about the concern that we have regarding Subdivision 8, which is in Section 2. So this is the new language about the data being collected by or submitted to the Department of Health and saying that it's not genetic information for the purposes of Section 13.386. Section 13.386 is the state genetic privacy law. And so we're concerned because it's exempt from the consent requirements of the state's genetic privacy law and the limits on the length of storage. And one of the things that we have been long concerned about with the Department of Health is the creation and the building of databases on children according to various different conditions and what this means for trust in the public health system or in the public health department, as well as what it means for the privacy and autonomy of individuals. And children, of course, grow up to be adults who now have information stored by the government on them. So we're concerned about the building of a database here because there would be no consent requirements regarding the storage, the use, the collection, and the dissemination of this information. We understand that parents may like to have this testing done, and that's perfectly fine, but we do not want to have them have this information stored and used beyond without their consent, not even knowing what's happening. The department is already using the screening results for research without some of it's with consent and some of it has been without consent. And so this has been a concern for us because we know that individuals have a right not to be research subjects, whether or not they have their name attached or not, because research often drives policy in a direction that they may not prefer it to be driven if they had only been asked how the information would be used. So we're not happy with lines 3.9, 3.10, and we have told that to Senator Benson.
I appreciate that. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this initiative? Senator Benson, you may not have the answer to this question. I hope the answer isn't because I put it in the bill. But maybe Ms. Hartnett can tell me why we have what we're talking about in this committee is that the extending the date from June 30th to 2019. Data privacy issues will be dealt with in judiciary, which right. is where we'll refer this. So the major question is, of this policy committee is it a good policy for you to extend your committee in order to continue the work that you're doing, which you've described.
Correct,
so
Senator.
Why do we want to terminate it in 2019?
Madam Chair, I think like all things that come before us, committees and commissions, committee in this case, the incentive to produce a work product that they could proudly present to the legislature to justify their existence or to say, you know what, we have fundamentally completed the work that we were given and there's no need for us to continue meeting, and the committee then sunsets. But this way there's some legislative check-in so these groups can be held accountable and can determine if their work is still necessary.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Is there language that asks for a check-in with us? To sometimes we have language in these bills that if they're doing work that they summarize their accomplishments to the chairs of the committees and the minority leads. Is there language that
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe there isn't anything that requires that reporting. There is a website that posts all of the reports online. Actually, all of the reporting is part of the national database. That's why getting back to the data retention issue, we'd be the only state in the United States that destroys its newborn hearing screening data. The only state. It's part of there's a national website that is called Improve Early Hearing Detection Intervention.org .org. It's part of the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. And so our report, or the Minnesota State report, is online, and all of the data is reported. But I'm sure the department would love to show off what they've been doing, because they've been doing phenomenal work, and the committee has been doing phenomenal work. So,
well, maybe I'm So I think the data and how the data is utilized is a separate question from what I'm asking.
Sure.
The question I am asking is that if this committee sees that it's a good idea because of the kind of work, because of the description that was given of what the task force's job is and what they have produced as a result of that, and because the work is not yet done of the task force, why not extend it to allow that? That's question number one. My question is, typical when we ask a task force to exist to report back to us that the task force has achieved certain objectives. So I'm not really talking about what the data is collected and used. That's a separate question. Is it reasonable for us? Would it be useful for us? Because the question may come again in 2019 to continue to extend and to offer the committee a chance to articulate why that should be extended. But we need data in order to make that decision. Ms. Hartnett.
This is Mary. As a member of the advisory committee and as a person who led the coalition to get this passed, I think it's a great idea to amend it and have the reporting occur.
Madam Chair, I presume that because they had presented a report, there was a report in here, but you are correct. They don't have any requirements for annual or biannual reporting, and so I would be amenable to amendment language to require an annual report to the chair and ranking member of the relevant committees.
Is that an oral amendment?
If council could help me place it in the right position in the bill, I would be happy to do so.
Well, it would, Madam Chair and members, it would go on, I suppose, you could put it on page 3 after line 5, do it as a new paragraph D.
And, Madam Chair, if I could propose that the committee be required to report in odd-numbered years so that they wouldn't spend all their time drafting a report to the chair and ranking member of the relevant health committee.
Complete a summary and report of the activities of the committee on
yes, Madam Chair,
on odd-numbered years.
I think you got that.
Is this going to go to state and local?
This is going to judiciary.
Okay. Wouldn't it also have to go to state and local? You're extending an advisory committee?
It may well have to go to state and local government as well. Senator Benson, is that your understanding?
I know it has been asked for in judiciary. I am not aware of any other requests at this point.
So why don't we work on this language? Maybe we can add it in judiciary and make sure we get it right.
Madam Chair, is that okay with you? Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah. That's a great idea. Our brains are all a little frazzled here today. So I just think it might be a good idea
right
to...
Put over the edge there.
That was a tough amendment. I'm sorry. Yeah. All right. Any further discussion on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Hearing no further discussion, Senator Benson renews her motion to pass Senate File 632 and refer it to Judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. It passes. We now have Senator Claussen with us, who will be presenting on Senate File 518. Hello, Senator Claussen. Do you have any amendments to the bill at this time?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Please proceed.
For the record, my name is Greg Claussen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate representing the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Coates, and Northeast Lakeville. And Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to meet with you today. You have in front of you Senate File 518. And the purpose of the file is to create a Minnesota Mental Health Summit. The summit would bring together the education and human services communities in our state for the purpose of developing a comprehensive workforce plan to address mental health needs. And the workforce plan is to address three basic areas. The first is increasing the number of mental health professionals and practitioners in the state. Second, to ensure proper professional preparation. And lastly, to increase diversity in the number of mental health professionals and practitioners. As you look at statistics from the Minnesota Departments of Education, Minnesota Departments of Health and Human Services, in any given year, one in four adults and one in five children experience a mental health disorder. Annually, an estimated 109,000 children and youth from ages birth to age 21 in Minnesota need treatment for serious emotional disturbances. And over the past several months, we have also heard of mounting concerns over the lack of mental health services available for our veteran populations. Perhaps most telling in support of Senate File 518 for a mental health summit was a December 18, 2012 CARE 11 interview with Dr. Charles Scholes. Dr. Scholes is a professor and head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. And I'd like to quote from that interview. "We have a shortage of available mental health appointments, a shortage of in beds available to our mental health hospital wings, and a shortage of day treatment centers. There is also a shortage of psychiatrists to provide acute care. Mental health care in Minnesota is facing a crisis in that it takes a long time for patients to get the treatments they need. And from my own experience as a high school principal and working with youth, I have found that it may take up to a month or more to schedule an appointment for mental health issues. At this time, I'd like to introduce people that are present today that will be introducing some testimony. I'd like to start with Sue Abderholden. She's the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. You've heard several bills already this session about the needs of both children and adults with mental illnesses in terms of services and supports in the community. And so it's not a surprise, I think, to anyone in this room that we have a very fragile mental health system. You've heard about the long wait times to access a psychiatrist or other mental health professional, or the wait times in emergency rooms, or people waiting in a hospital or at Anoka Regional Treatment Center to go to a less intensive setting. While some of the problems can be related to the lack of availability of the right services, a lot of the problems can be traced back to the lack of workers. We simply do not have enough people to work in the mental health field, starting with psychiatrists all the way down to behavioral health aides. You have a map in your handouts that shows the shortage areas for mental health, and you can see that all the regions except two have already been designated shortage areas. And I would guess, frankly, if you talked even to mental health providers in those two regions of the state, that they would say they still have difficulty recruiting and hiring mental health professionals as well. As the mental health system has begun to move towards evidence-based mental health treatment, best practices, and a focus on recovery, the need for changes in the education and training of the mental health workforce has become clear. As the population in Minnesota becomes more diverse, the need for a mental health workforce that reflects the people of Minnesota also increases. There have been, since I've been with NAMI 11 years, many studies, many work groups, many task forces, but we don't seem to be moving forward at all on this topic. We believe that what the state needs to do is to create a personnel development plan that addresses how to increase the number of people working in the field of mental health, how to improve their training and education, and how to increase the diversity of the workforce. We're not starting from scratch. There's actually a federal workforce development action plan that we can use. There are also several states that have done a really good job of laying out their workforce plan, and that includes Alaska, California, Connecticut, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, and Virginia. Not all of them, frankly, high population states, so I think we could learn a lot from them. NAMI believes that we simply cannot wait any longer. We can't wait for the shortages to get worse.
This bill will bring together all the key stakeholders, including really for the first time our higher education system, so that we can then create and then follow a plan that will address this issue. I know that you have a letter in support from the Minnesota Hospital Association. They also struggle with finding enough psychiatrists and other mental health professionals. And last night I received an email from MACE, the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, saying that they too supported this bill because they feel that EBD teachers and special ed teachers could use some additional training, especially on evidence-based practices, so that they could do better in the school as well. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Abderholden. Let's see, we have also with us.
Madam Chair, some of the people that we had on the agenda last night could not make it back this morning, so we have people that are not on your list.
Okay, great.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Ron Brand, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I'm glad to be here today to talk about an important problem. You know, the workforce concerns that you hear really will vary in the different kinds of positions that people hold, whether they're mental health professionals or psychiatrists or advanced practice nurses. They may be mental health practitioners. They may be mental health workers. And depending on which part of the system you're looking at, there are workforce problems in each of those. But the workforce solutions in each of those doesn't solve the problem of a lack of psychiatry, or having more psychiatrists doesn't solve the lack of having mental health practitioners who can do in-home services or other things. And so there's a way of we need to have a complementary and a comprehensive approach to this. The our members, we have member organizations that have about 3,200 employees, and there are workforce issues that apply to healthcare more generally, like the need to address population or demographic disparities, cultural competence, and aging population. We're in competition, really, for future leaders. College sophomores, what are they going to choose as a major, or graduate schools and residency choices? We are in competition with fast food and long-term care and retail for people who are big-hearted and they're unlicensed, but they have great people skills. There's problems in rural access. There's maldistribution of highly trained professionals that are currently concentrated in urban and hospital centers. But for mental health workforce, there's other issues that go beyond those that affect the healthcare workforce in general. There's fear and stigma and misinformation about mental illness. There's unattractive salaries and prospects for job futures. It's challenging and difficult work, and it's emotionally draining. There's a mismatch between education and training and the real-world job requirements, which requires our providers to do lots and lots of on-the-job training, clinical supervision, the workforce. Workforce areas are especially acute in areas of specialty services like children's mental health, services for older adults, services for people with serious and persistent mental illness, bicultural or bilingual, culturally specific services that require us to treat people with co-occurring alcohol or drug disorders or co-occurring other medical or chronic health problems. Workforce shortages are essentially a hole in our safety net. And we do a survey every other year to check on staff turnover and the length of time that it takes to hire people for job vacancies. And in general, for hiring people who are unlicensed direct care staff, it varies from 42% in a year to about 29%. And for licensed professionals, it typically is around 17-18% per year that they are having a turnover, which means there's a continuous need for training and a continuous need for attention to the job, the workforce development issues. I just want to underscore the need to have a comprehensive statewide approach to a problem that will only get worse as we go forward and the demand increases. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Grand. I put my glasses on and I can see what's going on down at that end. I don't have the long way. Patricia Starr.
Madam Chair, this is a speaker that would not be on your list, so perhaps we'll just ask her to introduce herself.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Glennis Edwall. I'm the director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
and I'm delighted to be here representing DHS's commitment to working with the partners that are specified in this bill and our great endorsement for bringing this proposition forward. I wanted to talk about just 4 points about why this particular activity of creating a workforce plan is so important to DHS. And it really echoes some of the things that you've already heard from other speakers, but it really pertains especially to public programs. And though I represent children's mental health particularly, I do want us to remember that at least half of adult mental health disorders have their roots in childhood. And so some of the things that I will talk about that may seem more specific to children really have ongoing consequences for the populations that are served in both the public and private sectors. First of all, as you have heard, there is still large unmet need. In our public programs, we estimate that we are serving about 45% of the population that we should be serving in terms of the prevalence estimates that are given to us by the federal government. We keep trying to address this problem by finding ways to increase access to services, but always the workforce is the rate-limiting factor of being able to do that. And so we need urgently to address this problem if we are going to really tap that problem of unmet need. Secondly, I think that as we have progressed in both the child and adult mental health systems in Minnesota over the last 20 years since the passage of the Comprehensive Adult and Children's Mental Health Acts, what we have been trying to do is to expand the continuum of services so that we can deliver the most effective care possible to persons who are affected by mental illness as early as possible. And that has meant really expanding a continuum of services so that we are trying to do the best, at least secondary and tertiary prevention that we can do, certainly good early intervention, and then excellent supports that to make sure that people recover and can be as resilient as possible for whatever may come next in their lives. Expanding that continuum has meant that we have also expanded the range of provider types that we need in order to make the system as a whole work well. So we're dependent not only on psychiatrists and on doctoral level psychologists, but on a whole range of different professionals and practitioners, all of which we now have shortages. And so at every level, from child and adolescent psychiatrists, the shortage of which is just stunning, all the way, though, through recruiting, training, and being able to retain mental health behavioral aides or rehabilitation workers in the adult system, we need a greater workforce in all parts of the system. One of the things that has become very clear as we have tried to create mechanisms to do this kind of expansion is that we also, though, need career ladders from one step or one kind of service provision to being able to have the qualifications for a more complicated or acute kind of service provision. And so we need ways when we bring behavioral health aides, for example, into our system for children, that we can also make it possible for them to attain the credentials to become practitioners, and should they choose, also professionals in ways that are compatible with our service delivery systems. So we very clearly need a work plan that helps us figure out how to do those career ladders as well. Third, as the speakers have already emphasized, we are acutely aware of the fact that we have an increasingly diverse population, and diversity always has children as its leading edge. So we need to meet the mental health needs of these diverse populations that are coming to populate Minnesota. It certainly means 2 things. First of all, that we need more culturally specific providers, and all of the reference groups in the children's mental health system clearly cry for more culturally specific providers. But we also need to be sure that all of our providers are trained so that they are appropriately culturally responsive to the increasingly diverse populations that they are serving. And then fourth, I really want to make it a plea that this is not just expanding the numbers of people, but it really is about making sure that we are finely attuned to their training needs so that they are as effective as possible when they do deliver services. An increasing research base to inform both diagnosis and treatment is certainly become much more prevalent in the last decade, meaning that we have the opportunities to improve the quality of care as well as outcomes for the individuals who are receiving our services. But that can only be done if we incorporate that research base better into both initial training and continuing education. The Department of Human Services has supported many initiatives to assure that any expansion of either providers or benefits is accompanied by quality standards and continued training to make sure that we are maximizing that effectiveness.
And so, in sum, the position of DHS that I've been asked to represent is that we indeed do need a workforce plan with three characteristics. It needs, as others have said, to be comprehensive in looking at this full range of both different levels of service provision and the quality standards and research bases that needs to be brought into training. Secondly, it needs to be a plan that has durability. This is not just figuring out how to do one more, expand one class of providers, but it means that we have a long-term plan that really incorporates all of the elements that we've addressed. And then third, that it must have multi-sector involvement and commitment. And we are most grateful, particularly for the commitment of higher education to partner with others in making this plan at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Edwald. Mental health has been a major focus of the committee this year, so this is another piece of that. And but the essence of it for the policy discussion is support for the development of a summit. Is that correct, Senator Claussen?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
You've given us a lot of other data and information about what the need is, but what you really hear about is to say because a plan needs to be developed to address these shortages, that what you hear about is support for a summit.
That's correct, and we've tried to outline what the tasks or specific outcomes would be of that summit as well.
Okay. Are there any further testimony from the audience on this issue? On the issue of having a summit or not? I'd like to focus on the issue in front of us. Great, thank you. Senator Hoffman, you had a question or a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both. I mean, this is really great news. Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Claussen. One of the things about the importance of doing a developmental plan for any kind of summit and having folks come together, I'm missing the parent involvement here in this piece. And if Ms. Abderholden would come and assure me that parents are just as much as actively involved, and my assumption is with you three up there it is, but I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hoffman. Ms. Abderholden, did you want to respond?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, absolutely, parents will be involved. You know, one of the bills that you actually heard earlier this year was the creation of family peer specialists because they have a role to play, too, in developing our workforce in the mental health field. And with NAMI at the table, and I think many of you know, nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or are a family member, we will definitely have family members at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just a moment. Ms. Abderholden, who will be invited to this summit? I mean, are people who have had experience and difficulty accessing appropriate levels of providers, are they invited to come to this meeting, or is this a group that's primarily pulling together our stakeholders that have the capacity to create a resolution to the problem?
Madam Chair, I think we'll definitely see peer specialists, so adults who live with a mental illness who are working in the field as well and have come to it from their life experience, which we value very highly. I think we will see, members of the Consumer Survivor Network who have also had that lived experience as well. So we see it as kind of a large group. We want to make sure that all the stakeholders, including the Black psychiatrists, Black social workers, the various guilds, that everybody really is there to provide input into the future development of our workforce.
Madam Chair, just to emphasize.
Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to emphasize that there will be a number of working groups that will be working in the communities gathering information for this summit prior to and after. So just so you understand that we will be reaching out across the state for input.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. I think that's really great to think about because you can spend your whole time sort of describing the problem and getting testimony, so to speak, from people that affirm that the problem exists. And that's a very different summit than a summit that brings to the table people who have the capacity to make a commitment to a process. And so I'm hoping that should this pass, that the outcome of that will be that people at the table are really creating a proposal of what the course and direction would be to resolve this particular part of the problem, and that they're willing to commit some of their resources to make that happen. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abderholden, I'm sure you've already thought about some of the agenda for the summit. Are you taking a look at other programs that have worked well, particularly the the training and the workforce development for long-term care and what they've done with the grants and the educational reimbursements that they have going forward.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Havdar-Oldman.
Senator Rosen, absolutely. We're going to look at what's been done before in other fields and also what's been done in other states. I mean, again, Alaska, for example, has a great workforce development plan. And as you can imagine, transportation in Alaska, you know, those little planes that I won't get on, it is a problem. So I think we have a lot to learn from other states. Not that everyone, not all 50 have them, and not all the ones that have them are great, but there are some that are really very good. And, you know, I don't think we have to start from scratch, which I think is okay. Which is the good part. And in reference to Madam Chair, too, I think we've been admiring the problem for quite some time. And so my goal is not to admire it anymore, but to actually address it.
Yeah, thank you. In this handout that you've given us that describes when an area of the state has been designated something, would you make it clear what's being designated here? HPSA, Minnesota Rational Services Areas. What? I don't understand what this is telling me. This form.
Madam Chair, so this is from the Department of Health, and it's the health professional shortage areas. So they look at the number of mental health professionals per population, and then if you don't meet a certain level, which I can't tell you exactly what that is, but then it's deemed a shortage area. And they do this for a number of different healthcare professionals, including primary care, I know is one. I believe actually nurses is another one. And what I did is took off their website the mental health professional.
Great. Thank you. There's been a recommendation that Senator Clausen that we add online 1.12, where where it says special education, that we might say representatives, so that it's, although we do say private colleges, University of Minnesota. It was just noted that we might want to name. Put a representative behind that rather than just special ed. You want representatives there, not special ed, right? Representative special ed. And if you would make that oral amendment, we would add on line 1.12 after special education and before the comma the word representatives.
I would view that as a friendly amendment and would ask that we add on line 1.12 representatives after special education.
So moved.
It's been moved. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. And would you like to make a motion, Senator Rosen, on the bill?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file 518 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to finance.
To finance.
Thank you.
Senator Marty, on the motion.
Madam Chair, I definitely support the motion. I just wanted to say to Senator Clausen and those involved in this that it's about time we do this. We spend a lot of time talking about access to health care financially and so on for obvious reasons, but we've got a problem not just in terms of mental health, though this may be the most severe. I mean, general practitioners, lots of medical professionals we are shortages of in certain geographic areas we have shortages of. I keep thinking for all the effort and money a sixth of our economy we're putting into health care and we never figure out how to make sure we have the practitioners, which is equally important for access. And so starting with mental health is a wonderful thing to do, and I understand. I mean, yeah, nobody has to restate how serious the problem is. You've stated that very well, but I'm glad you're actually bringing people together because we ought to be doing this in other areas of healthcare as well. But you've got perhaps one of the most severe problems, so I'm glad you're moving forward.
Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you. We'll take an action on this, but I just would like to add another comment, Senator Clausen, as this moves forward, and to Ms. Havdar-Oldman, too. I've been hearing a number of concerns and complaints from a variety of sectors when we're talking about increasing the workforce, we're talking about educating more people, and the institutions, the Minsky institutions in particular, are contacting me that they're having difficulty placing students in clinical sites for the experience that they have, they need in order to be adequately prepared for the profession. So as you engage in this summit, I don't think it can be a disconnect between that and the holdup that can happen in the higher ed system because hospitals we have to take a look at what hospitals and clinical sites are doing to allow our students in, or if they're restricting that, or if they're allowing students from outside of the state to come in, and then our own programs can't have access to clinical contact. So please add that to your considerations during the summit. And if you have recommendations, we'd love that as well. Okay, great. Thank you. All those in favor of the motion to move Senate File 518 to Finance, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? It passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Okay, we are now looking at Senate File 384, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, with your permission, could we do Senate File 699 first?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
So Senate File 699 is offered by Senator Marty moves Senate File 699. She wants that one first. Senate File 699 be passed and referred to Finance. Do you have any amendments at this time?
I do not.
Okay, so please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to call your attention. I'm going to make very short opening comments because I do have three other testifiers who are much more knowledgeable in the area of doulas and better birth outcomes than I am. But there was an article in the March 5th Star Tribune at the bottom of the fold about C-section rates. And part of why we're here is that we continue to have unnecessarily high C-section rates among our birthing population. And we're going to tell you that the research really shows that by using the support services of a doula, we can lower those C-section rates. Not only that, but we have better birth outcomes in general, and we have better parental satisfaction. Women feel better about their birthing experience. They're more happy with their hospital care providers. And they even think that their partners did a better job when they have doulas. When I had my children 30 years ago, the services of a doula were not really available, so my husband had to fill in. And I did also have midwives, which was very supportive. But my daughters, as many of you may know, I have 15 grandchildren. And my daughters, if I can't be there to provide the doula services, then I have encouraged them, and in many cases they have, used the services of a doula. For that very reason, is they want better birth outcomes. They want to feel better about the experience. And to have a trained birth attendant who can be with you providing that support and just letting your spouse, you know, hold your hand or take pictures. And it's just kind of a better situation for all involved. So to start with, Madam Chair, I'd like to, you can talk about the bill itself to describe the bill. Yeah, Madam Chair, Senate File 669 would allow the coverage of doula services under medical assistance. Doula services traditionally entail assisting a woman before, during, or after childbirth and providing information, physical assistance, and emotional support to the mother and her family. The services cannot be covered without receiving federal approval, and it's unclear. So what we would like is to be able to add doula services to the state Medicaid plan. So our testifiers here to start with is Emma Corbet from the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And if you're testifying, I don't know if you're prepared to do this, but or maybe Senator Pappas can. Can I draw from what you're saying that if this is added to the state Medicaid plan, that we cannot assume that there'll be coverage from the federal government for a share of these costs, or that it cannot proceed until there's federal approval?
If someone was here. Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't believe we can actually answer that question right now. We're really hoping that it can just be heard in this committee and pass this committee, and then some of the financial pieces are unknown at this time. But we do have precedent in some other states where that I'll outline in my little talk here, where there has been some federal coverage for dual assistance for Medicaid moms at great cost savings. So
So you're saying that for the purposes for today, since you really can't answer the questions about how and what the sources of revenue would be to fund this expansion, that you'd want us to focus here on whether or not we think it in general, if we could afford it, including doula services as covered services, is a good idea or not. That's the policy question for us today.
Yes.
Thank you. Summed it up.
Proceed.
My name is Emmy Corbet. I am a doula. I'm also a midwife, and I'm a very enthusiastic member of the Minnesota Better Birth Coalition. We have been coming here under the sponsorship of Senator Sandy Pappas and many of the members of this committee for the past 10 years to seek to make doula care more available to birthing women in Minnesota. For the last decade, we have done this because we know that doula care, professional labor support, prenatally, during labor and birth, and in the postpartum period, is evidence-based care that has been upheld by the highest quality research, including the Cochrane database. It is the gold standard of research. Dozens of demonstrated projects around the country have proven that doula care increases many birth outcomes. Doula care has an A rating from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. The criteria was reviewed in the November 2008 American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. The federal government has funded doula care through special programs such as the HRSA for many years, and nationally over 30 programs in 16 states are uniting to lobby for permanent Medicaid payment for doulas. There are two new developments which have really spurred our committee on and have brought you this bill today. Oregon recently, just in January, has written doula care into their state plan, and they received a waiver from CMS to pay the federal 50% share of doula costs. That started in January 1, 2013. On February 4th, I believe you all have a summary of the study published on February 14th of this year, published in the American Journal of Public Health by Professor Katie Osmanal of the University of Minnesota. She demonstrated that broad-based doula care would save the U.S. billions of dollars annually and millions of dollars statewide. This is a local professor. She's here in Minnesota. She collected her data from local women on Medicaid, Medicare programs. You're going to hear from one of the doulas today who works for the program which collected these statistics. So that study, the fact that Oregon is already covering doula bills, were based on the outcomes of this, serving these Medicaid recipients exclusively. Unfortunately, Mary Williams, one of the founders of Everyday Miracles, could not be here today. She was here last night at 6 o'clock ready to testify and got delayed. So right now we have Barbara McIntyre. She is an active doula with Everyday Miracles. She has been working in the health and wellness field her entire life, and she will speak about the Everyday Miracles data and the more exciting numbers that weren't even included in the study but are showing us that women who have doula care are having much lower C-section rates, a cost savings to the state of Minnesota.
Welcome, Ms. McIntyre.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, even if it's not a cost savings, it's still a good idea to have less C-section rates.
Yes, the results for C-section rates among Medicaid beneficiaries was 31.5, and the results for doula supported births was 22.3. And the corresponding preterm birth rates, 7.3 Medicaid and 6.1, respectively. After control the clinical and social demographic factors, odds of cesarean delivery were 4.9 lower for doula-supported births. So basically, state Medicaid programs should consider offering coverage for birth doulas to realize potential cost savings associated with reduced cesarean rates. So the cesarean rates currently in the U.S., 26.5, and for everyday miracles, our cesarean rates are 17%. For premature births, the current U.S. stats, 12.7, and for everyday miracles, 6.8. Our low birth weights currently in the U.S., 8.2, and for everyday miracles, it's 4%. Breastfeeding, which is huge, currently in the U.S., 74%. For everyday miracles, it's 97%. And the amount of mothers who continue breastfeeding their babies for over a year, it's amazing.
Do you know what Everyday Miracles is? I don't know if the committee knows.
Oh, Everyday Miracles is an organization that was developed by two women, Mary and Debbie. And it's a birthing place where... Well, you know, actually, I'm very new at this, and I'm extremely nervous.
You are doing great. You are doing great.
Please take that part.
You're doing great. You're doing great. You're doing just great. You're articulating. We've gotten your message that the data is clearly demonstrating that this does create a better outcome with doula services and forms the basis for why this committee should support this bill. So you've done a great job. Was there another person that wanted to testify?
Yeah, just so you can all understand what Everyday Miracles is, it's a nonprofit organization started by two doulas who recognize the need for low-income moms to get good care for their birthing time. So currently, there are many private doulas who charge a lot of money to attend a birth, and they're well worth every penny they charge. But women on Medicaid, Medicare, can't pay $500 out of pocket to pay a doula. So Mary Williams and Debbie Prudhomme started Everyday Miracles, I don't know how many
Ten years ago.
Yeah. And they are serving hundreds of eligible women, so women who are on state Medicaid programs. They have very unstable funding, but they pay doulas to visit these mothers prenatally. They provide education, support, companionship. They attend the birth. And they provide postpartum breastfeeding support, support for postpartum depression. So these doulas are paid. They're paid very low wages, and the funding for Everyday Miracle doulas is extremely unstable.
Thank you.
They only serve women on Medicaid or Medicare. That's one of the criteria for being accepted into, you know, being eligible for a doula. So that's what Everyday Miracles is, and they have outstanding statistics.
Thank you. And the person to your left is?
I'm Suzanne Swanson. I am the founding director of Pregnancy and Postpartum Support Minnesota, and I'm a psychologist in practice, working almost exclusively with pregnancy and postpartum for over 35 years. So I have seen up close the benefits of a doula. But today, actually, I'm not here to speak for myself. I'm here to speak for two other women who were here last night and could not rearrange their schedules today. So I'm going to be LaVon Moore, who is a certified nurse midwife at North Point Health and Wellness Center, and Dr. Mary Seeker-Ra, who is the administrative director and health systems navigator at the Cultural Wellness Center in South Minneapolis. If I may first, Madam Chairman, speak to the points that LaVon asked me to raise with you. African Americans have twice the infant mortality in Minnesota of the overall rate. The prematurity rate and low birth weight rate are also significantly more than that of other populations groups in Minnesota. This makes Minnesota near the bottom of the 50 states in regard to disparities between African American and Native American women and all other cultural groups in Minnesota. Levon believes that having doulas of color will impact these health disparities positively. It's important that with Medicaid reimbursement, doulas will be able to be trained and paid. Ideally, she says eventually there'll be more nurses and nurse midwives also who are African American or Native American. But doulas are needed in their own right then, and also they're an excellent bridge between the current situation with very little culturally appropriate care and having many more birth professionals of color in the future. She kind of concludes with saying African American and Native American women deserve culturally appropriate care. And funding this care is cost effective, as we've seen, and also it could become a workforce development project in our communities. I would also like to read the testimony of Akmeri Sikara. Akmeri says, I'm sorry I cannot join you this morning to talk to you in person. I've been a birth attendant and a doula for over 20 years. I work for the Cultural Wellness Center, where we work with pregnant women and their families to ensure that they have the kind of birth they want to have. Our birthing team model is one that consists of an array of culturally based strategies to prevent infant mortality and preterm birth. In this model, women are supported by a traditional birth attendant from their culture through pregnancy, birth, and into the postpartum period. I have attended all kinds of births with all kinds of women. Most of the births I have attended are with African or African-American women. Many of the women I am there for don't have any support and are afraid of the process. They might be here in Minnesota with no close family members present and no one who looks like them. I am there to talk them through the process. When Jamila, not her real name, arrived in 1996 to the United States from Somalia, she had no idea the amount of personal anguish she would encounter while trying to have a baby. In her homeland, women helped each other from preconception to 1 year after birth, so Jamila thought she'd naturally receive that sort of support here in the U.S. But that was not her experience. Jamila said she came to Minneapolis because of its large Somali community and she wanted to be closer to her people. But what she found was that the culture and the sense of community she had hungered for were straining under the weight of American life, where competition and individualism had taken root and displaced the indigenous ways of her people. Consequently, Jamila went through her pregnancy alone, and when labor began, she went to the hospital alone, where she was told by doctors and nurses that she needed an emergency C-section, she said. When I first got to the hospital, I was told that I was dilated to 6, but then the doctor said I was only open to 1, and the baby's heart rate was low. That's when he handed me the paper to sign. Jamila had the surgery without knowing what she had consented to, she said. My next pregnancy, I knew that I wouldn't be alone. I knew what to do. That's when I found Akmeri. And when she told me that I was in charge of my own body, that sounded right. Jamila and I talked about her previous birth experience. We talked about what went right and what she would like to see changed. I went to medical appointments with her. We talked about the possibilities of having a VBAC, that's vaginal birth after cesarean. Her OB, who was very supportive and encouraging, said that if that was what she wanted, she could see how things went. Jamila and I continued to meet throughout the pregnancy, talking about how she had to trust her body and trust the birth process. Her birth story could be different this time. We meditated together. We talked to the baby. When Jamila began the labor process, she called me. We stayed home and waited till active labor was in process. We arrived at the hospital, and I set the tone with the hospital staff and Jamila, decorating her bedside with African fabric, smells of lavender and ginger to relax her, familiar things, and my familiar face. Jamila was dilated to 7 by the time we got to the hospital and delivered a healthy 7-pound daughter 3 hours later, VBAC. She had the kind of birth she wanted. I believe having cultural support is important for all families of color. We might not be related, but at that moment we are. A knowledgeable, supportive birth attendant or doula can encourage the mother and the baby and reassure them that they can have the kind of birth they want and deserve.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from members of the committee? The question in front of us is to approve Senate File 699, offered by Senator Marty. No further discussion. All those in favor? Senator Nino.
And the bill goes where?
And the bill goes to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. And thank you very much for your presence.
Thank you very much.
It's important. Okay, Senator Pappas, we will now, are you ready to move to your other bill? We do have some time constraints, so I hope that people will respect some containment and focus on their testimony to the bill. I see there's a number of testifiers here, so I hope that you are each bringing different perspectives or points on the bill forward, and we can avoid some repetition. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Birth stories always make me cry. So, I just wanted to start out, as I did with the previous bill, with a little story. And some of you might have heard this already, but we're talking about sex trafficking, and a lot of times people think that that doesn't happen in my neighborhood, in my community. That's something, you know, it's either international or it's just in some other city, in Minneapolis, maybe. Whatever we think. Well, I live downtown St. Paul, and last fall there was a 911 call from a hotel that is connected to my apartment building by Skyway. It's the downtown Hilton DoubleTree. And it was a young woman, a 17-year-old, who called and said, "I need help. I think they're going to kill me." And she was a 17-year-old runaway from Iowa who was being held there against her will, and over the previous week, she'd been forced to service over 30 men. And she thought at that point that they were going to kill her, and she managed to get to a phone and call 911 and was rescued. And her traffickers were prosecuted. But this is in my neighborhood. This is personal. And it can be in your neighborhood, because sex trafficking is really a more hidden crime. You know, it may be on the back pages of what's it called? Craigslist. Maybe on the back pages of Craigslist, or it may be on the street in some neighborhood, or it may be in a hotel room, or maybe in someone's basement. But the average age of entrance into prostitution is 13. And these are little girls who don't say, "I want to grow up and be a prostitute." They are victimized. They are vulnerable. They are appealed to. Their trafficker may be the only one who says they love them. And there becomes an emotional bond there. And what we're trying to do with this bill is really break through that emotional bond with the trafficker and say and take a victim-centered approach. These are young girls in need of protection and services. They're not criminals. They're not juvenile delinquents. And if we treat them as juvenile delinquents, we just send them back to their trafficker. But if we can treat them and develop a rapport and a bond with them, then the healing process can start. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Jeff Bauer from the Family Partnership, who can talk about the safe harbor legislation and the no wrong door approach.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, and will you be moving through the segments of the bill? Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. The first thing I want to do is just thank Senator Pappas so much for her leadership on this issue. I think there hasn't been any anti-trafficking legislation that you haven't been the author of over the years in Minnesota, and so we all just appreciate you so much. Thank you as well to you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori and Senator Rosen for agreeing to be co-authors on this legislation. It means the world to all of us. And I can tell you, without exaggerating, you're going to help save the young lives of children in our state because of your commitment to this bill, and I thank you for that. I just want to walk you through the portions of this bill really quickly, very quickly, given your time constraints. So just starting with Article 1, the first thing that we really wanted to do, we're building a system that's never been built, not only in Minnesota but around the country. And so we need to establish a statewide director position to hold the operation together. And so Section 1 of Article 1 establishes a director of child sex trafficking prevention in the Minnesota Department of Health. That person's responsibilities will be many. Among those will be to administer grant funds, to collect data and research and do the evaluation to make sure that we're doing what we need to do, and really being that point of contact, holding the whole operation together. In Section 2 of Article 1, we're proposing the establishment of 6 regional navigator positions. These would be roughly northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, and 2 in the metro area. These would be grant-funded positions. They would be housed within existing organizations. These wouldn't be new state employees. And so it could look different in northwestern Minnesota than it looks in southeastern Minnesota. And we did that by design. We want to give local communities the flexibility to build this how makes sense to them. This person's really the person who knows how to connect the dots. And so whether we have a child sex trafficking victim in Thief River Falls or in Mankato, this person knows how to get her the shelter she needs, the services she needs, can really connect her to everything she needs. Section 3 of Article 1 deals with program evaluation. Because this is a new model, we want to make sure that we're doing it well and effectively, and so we want to have a robust program evaluation so we can come back in 2 years and talk about how it went and make the adjustments we need to. Moving on to Article 2, this will look familiar to some of you from 2 years ago when we were initially working on Minnesota's safe harbor law. It did not include 16 and 17-year-olds. Over the past 18 months, we've heard the message loud and clear from our prosecutors, one of whom you'll hear from in a minute, from our law enforcement, from service providers, that we really need to be just covering every child under the age of 18 who is trafficked in the state. So Article 2 does that. And then last but not least, Article 4, appropriations for this bill. We are requesting $13.5 million for the biennium. $8.5 million of that would be for safe shelter and housing. And I wanted to say really quickly on this issue, the type of shelter and housing that child sex trafficking victims needs is a different kind of shelter and housing than, say, an average homeless young person would need. We do fully support. We know there's another proposal going through for $8 million for the Homeless Youth Act. We strongly support that proposal as well because we know that any child who's homeless is at severe risk for being sexually exploited. What we're talking about in Article 4 is highly therapeutic, highly secure shelter and housing for children who have been trafficked. They're often being very directly pursued by their trafficker, and so the level of security they need is much higher. They've been through tremendous abuse, and so the level of therapy they need is higher as well. So,
Madam Chair, this is Article 3 for you because we had deleted Article 3 in the previous committee.
Yes, thank you for that, Senator. We did. Article 3. So that housing money is roughly split in half. $4 million of that would be one-time renovation and construction costs. Right now in the entire state of Minnesota, there are only 4 shelter beds dedicated to child sex trafficking victims. And those are all in St. Paul. We estimate when the law goes into effect that we'll need between 35 and 40 around the state of Minnesota. And so there's quite the gap. We need to build those between now and August 2014. The other $4.5 million is to operate those shelter beds. This number is a bit higher, again, than it would be for an average homeless youth bed because of the level of security, because of the level of therapeutic services. The other part of Article 3 in your bill is within the Department of Health. There's roughly $2 million worth of staffing and grants for additional workers. That would be the regional navigators and 14 additional outreach workers around the state. There's $2 million over the biennium for a comprehensive safe harbor services fund. This would be competitive grant funds. It would be available to organizations across the state and could cover anything from mental health counseling services to legal advocacy to clothes and food. And then last in Article 3 is the Safe Harbor Training Fund. This is another message we heard loud and clear from around the state, from law enforcement and others, is that child sex trafficking cases are notoriously difficult for 2 reasons. 1, the victims are really, really hard to identify. Most often they will not self-identify, and unless a law enforcement officer knows the right questions to ask and the right way to ask those questions, they will not be able to identify the victim. The flip side of that is these cases can also be very hard to investigate, and our county attorney can attest to that. And so to have that training to investigate these cases, to get the prosecutions, is necessary. So that's the bill in a nutshell. I also want to just very quickly thank the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, who is also here today. They've given you a letter of support. They handed out to all of you today. They've been tremendous supporters all over the state, and I thank you so much for being here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, before we go to the next witness, I neglected to mention that the No Wrong Door report that's included in your materials in this bill is the product of 8 months of hard work on the part of service providers, law enforcement professionals, philanthropy, advocates, and survivors of sex trafficking around the state, with coordination and input from the Departments of Public Safety, Health, Human Services, and the financial support of the Women's Foundation. So it really is a big group effort. And Advocates for Human Rights has been involved from almost the beginning on trafficking legislation as well, plus a lot of law enforcement.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mark Ostrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Ostrom. I'm the Olmsted County Attorney. I realize we have a very limited amount of time, and my goal is to share with you why this is important to us. And this is the way I'd like to start it. As you all know, and I'm very happy and proud to say this, Olmsted County is a very safe, very healthy, and very happy place to live. And I would like to believe, just like Senator Pappas, that this does not go on in my community. It's unfortunate, though, to come to that realization that, in fact, it is happening. Many of you may have heard of Mission 21. Stephanie Holt is an advocate down in the Rochester area who is working very hard to create a resource for victims of juvenile prostitution, of juvenile trafficking. I spoke with her a couple of weeks ago, and as Mr. Bauer indicated, there's only 4 beds currently available in the entire state. Speaking to her a couple of weeks ago, she indicated that on one weekend, she had 3 young women, young girls, that needed a safe place to go. There's only 4 beds in the entire state. None of those are down in Rochester, and she had 3 girls that needed it right then. These people, these young ladies, these victims, they don't come to us between 8 and 5 during the day. They come to us at all hours of the day, mostly at night, and they've got very emergent and serious needs, necessary needs right now. They need a place to sleep. They need some food. They need perhaps health care. They're often in a very unsafe situation. They probably have somebody that's pursuing them, or they've been somehow pulled out of a very unsafe environment. We've had a lot of discussion with law enforcement, local law enforcement, and how we're going to treat these victims when we come across those. Again, often at midnight or 3 in the morning, where are we going to take them? We don't have the beds. The knee-jerk reaction is often to take them to the juvenile detention center. And that's probably the worst place you can take somebody like this. These are victims. These are people that need help. We've made a commitment in Olmsted County and in many of the metro counties not to treat these young victims as criminals, but actually to treat them as victims. And so why would we take them to a detention center and treat them as a criminal? How are we going to get their attention, and how are we going to provide those services and get their confidence that we're here to help if we're taking them to a detention center? As Mr. Bauer indicated, at any given time, we could probably use 30 to 35 beds. I think that might even be an understatement. The need is so significant, it's hard to estimate what we need. Again, speaking with Stephanie just a couple of weeks ago, when she tells me that in Rochester she needed 3 beds, you know, in one night, it makes me very uncomfortable to think that this is going on in my neighborhood. Again, I think Olmsted County couldn't be a more safer place to live. I thought the only place that trafficking went on was in the metro areas like Minneapolis and St. Paul. But it's occurring in every community in the state, and we need these facilities in every community in this state. I guess I could talk for hours, and I know you've got very limited time. I certainly would stand for any questions. But please understand that many of us have put a lot of thought and time into what the appropriate resources needs are, and we've presented, I think, a package here that is very honest and doesn't have a lot of fluff in it. We understand that there's not a lot of money out there available. $13 million seems like an awful lot of money, but when we're talking about the lives of very young children who have been abducted, they don't go into this willingly. They've been abducted into this, and they need help getting out. This is a very serious issue. And we certainly hope that this committee and the balance of the legislature will look on it very favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrom. And before we go to our next testifier, I think that the press conference that you had on this issue and the overall effort that you are attempting to raise an energy level or a sense of the crisis and the serious nature of this activity that goes on below the visual, our vision. And so you're wanting to go on and on is really, I think, a reflection of that you think you have to go on and on, or that then somehow there's more that you can say that will create an energy on us to understand the seriousness of this problem and how vulnerable this population is and how invisible it is if you don't open your eyes and pay attention to it. But I think that this committee understands that. And so I would just respond to you that I do not think, unless there are others on the committee that are not persuaded that this is a serious issue that needs an intervention of this nature, I don't think this committee needs to be persuaded that it's serious. So with that, we can go to our next testifier. Would you introduce yourself and present to the committee?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Artika Roller. I am the program director at the Family Partnership of the PRIDE program. PRIDE stands for Out of Prostitution into Independence, Dignity, and Equality. We are over 35 years old and the oldest program within the state that has provided support services for sexually exploited women and young girls. Commercial sexual exploitation is a persuasive problem here in Minnesota. The issue of exploitation is particularly difficult to address since the girls are hidden. They live with shame. They also live with fear. They're hidden from the public eye. Their family members and other adults in their lives do not recognize the symptoms of victimization, or we're in denial that this happens to teens here in Minnesota. The safe harbor model is critical because our current model of protecting young women include locking them up in juvenile detention centers when we don't have safe places for them to go. There is no other model that locks up victims if there's not a safe place for them to go. The safe service providers are required, or they require a different amount of knowledge, perspective, and support when they're working with young women to address these needs. Assisting youth to escape exploitation requires a system of services, not just one type of service. And that system is not currently in place. We need to coordinate our efforts with other care providers, including child welfare services, behavioral health, and the juvenile justice system. Although we support youth shelters, this shelter that we are talking about is specific shelter with trauma-informed, holistic approach to providing services that have experienced massive amounts of trauma. Also, if we house victims in juvenile detention centers or in places that don't have the specialized expertise in this area, because they have already been victimized, it puts children at risk for additional victimization, including additional sexual exploitation. This is very important that we adopt a system approach to intervention using multitudes and different modalities to address this issue. I do want to be brief, but I want to share a little bit about the work that we do with these young women. We see approximately 100 young women that are at high risk or that have already been victimized through sexual exploitation in Minnesota per year. I will tell you a small story about a young lady, and I will call her Bonnie. Bonnie had been sexually exploited. She was trafficked in Minnesota, but also trafficked nationally. We've seen her. She could not go back to her home or her community because her trafficker, or what we would call her pimp, really had intimidated her family in her community around what was going on with Bonnie. We met Bonnie in the juvenile detention center. She was 16 years old. She had been in the detention center for 8 months waiting for the trial to occur. She looked at her advocate and she said, "I am not a bad girl. I am really not a bad girl. I didn't know that this was going to happen to me." And the reason why we assume that she thought she was bad is because she was currently in a juvenile detention center and had been a victim, not a delinquent.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. Are there questions from members of the committee? I'm looking at the housing options. I think that if this is among the materials for the members of the committee, so I just was curious, when you're talking about this housing initiative, because they need a very specific kind of support system around them, is that housing a facility with 35 beds or something, or are you designing community-based safe homes with specially trained family members? And then follow up on that. I read that when it's appropriate through assessment, you might return the person to their home. Is there, in that instance, as a part of this plan, resources available to train family members to create the same environment that you might have if they were placed in a more intensive or secure facility or individual home?
Mr. Bauer is going to address that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. To answer the first part of your question, this would not be one facility. We really want to build this to be a regional system. And so we'd imagine that those 35 to 40 beds would be distributed throughout the state. Rochester is a great example of a place that could sure use a few of those. And one of the main reasons behind that is because the substitute for juvenile detention to keep a child safe often is to relocate that child away from her trafficker. And so we would imagine a regional system working where we may need to relocate a child from Bemidji down to Benson, Minnesota, or from Duluth to Rochester to keep them safe. And so these would be throughout the state. They would be various kinds of housing. There will be some that's very secure because these children are in immediate danger. In some circumstances, a specially trained foster family could be the place for a child that has worked in other places, like Portland is trying that model with some success. But to get to the second part of your question, of course, you know, if we can reunite a child with their family and that's safe, because sometimes those are the places where the trafficking is occurring. But if we can, that's an ideal situation. We actually had not explicitly stated training for families to whom these children might be returning. I think it's a fabulous idea, and I think we will definitely put that in the planning now that we've heard that question from you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Pappas.
Just so you're aware, another thing that's going on in the private sector under the leadership of Marilyn Carlson Nelson at Carlson Companies is training of hotel personnel to recognize trafficking. Because to me, it's like, why didn't the hotel clerk notice that something was going on? I mean, I'm told that she went down to the desk at one time and asked for scissors and didn't bring it back, and she kept it under her pillow for her to use to defend herself when they came to kill her. You know, and who can understand what's going through a victim's mind, why they don't call? It's similar to a battered wife or a battered partner. Is they're so emotionally controlled by the trafficker that they're paralyzed in terms of doing what they need to do to become safe or to get away. So training hotel personnel has been going on in Ramsey County, and to recognize, in fact, my husband works for TSA, and he said they're training airport officials if they see someone coming through the airport security to recognize the signs of someone who's being controlled and maybe brought against their will.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Are there any questions from committee members? All right, then. Senator Hoffman moves passage of Senate File 384, and it be referred to Finance.
Lucky Senator Lori.
Did you want to make the motion, Senator Lori?
No,
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony.
Much,
thank you very much. Let's see. We have one bill left. We have one bill left, Senator Marty, on Senate File 1017. Senator Marty offers Senate File 1017 be passed, recommended to pass, and referred to the Judiciary Committee. Do you have any amendments at this time, Senator Marty?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will have an amendment. Maybe I'll offer the amendment now and explain the bill. This is
kind of getting in your way.
I don't know. There are two amendments, one of which puts the bill in the shape that the House adopted it, which is the A1 amendment.
Okay. Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Is there a second amendment, did you say, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is explain the rest of the bill because it's separate from that one, and I think it would be helpful. Maybe what I'd like to do is have Mr. Koppel from the Department of Health speak to the bill and go through it for us, and then talk further. And then I had the other one I'd like to consider at that point.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. And just to give you a background for this legislation, last year we passed a newborn screening legislation, which was in response to a court decision in 2011. That court decision referenced a genetic privacy statute in making its determination and changes for the newborn screening program. As we went through newborn screening last year and we're getting it in order, what we were responding to in genetic privacy is that in order to collect, use, disseminate, or store biological specimens or data, you need to either have consent or you need express authority. Express authority meaning legislation. So that's what we did with newborn screening last year. We went through the process of giving newborn screening express authority. What we learned as we did that was that many of the programs that we run in the Department of Health are run like many other agencies. We have general authority from the legislature to go do something. You've told us to go do something. In order to do it, we may collect data or use it or store it or disseminate it. But we've been given the general authority to do that, not the express authority, meaning specifically in law. What we were concerned about were the many programs where, whether it's disease outbreaks, investigation of restaurants, food poisoning, et cetera, that we needed express authority in other areas of the work that we do. So we asked and received last year 1 year hold harmless on the department that we not be open to any lawsuits or legal proceedings around these things until we had a chance to look through the programs that we had and come back with a recommendation to the legislature. Our recommendation is this legislation. This legislation basically takes the programs and processes the Department of Health uses to carry out our mission. And these are programs and policies that have been passed by the legislature. They're not invented. These are all things that over decades have been passed. And this bill basically gives us express authority to carry out those functions. By having express authority, all we're doing is limiting our liability for other lawsuits to come forward or potentially saying we don't have the specific statutory authority, we only have general authority or we only have rulemaking. And that was what the Supreme Court used in its decision and what we don't want to revisit with the programs we operate now. This legislation gives us no more authority than we have now. There is no change in any of the programs or any activities that the Department of Health does. This simply gives us the express authority to continue doing what we have been doing and removes any vulnerabilities in terms of or liabilities in terms of any potential court actions. It also does not, it specifically excludes newborn screening, to make that clear, because we dealt with that last year. It has express authority now and is not included in this legislation, and we make that clear as well. I can go through it section by section, but it generally talks about the various activities of the department and what we are seeking in express authority.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Koppel. I'll hold off on having you go through section by section because I think that your explanation determines the essence of what we're being asked to do, which is give express authority rather than to a set of functions that you're engaged in under rules at this time, as it relates to a set of data that you collect. All right, great. Senator Marty, do you have other?
Sure, I have Mr. Oren from the department as well. I don't know that he's planning to speak. He's legal counsel there and can address it. And Ms. Braves wanted to speak in concerns about the bill. And I don't know if this is appropriate time, so I will offer a 5 amendment at this time. And while it's being distributed, I'll explain that. And this is one, and I have discussed it with the department. It's not initiated by them. I think this is one that, again, the newborn screening issue was resolved 2 years ago in a manner where the blood spots from newborn screening would be kept for, I think it's 71 days, and then the data from those spots would be kept for 2 years and then destroyed. And the one thing that I think is clear that those dates were kind of pulled out of a hat, it sounds like, from the way people I've talked with, some of the medical professionals who have concerns about it. And this being the health committee, although this all touches heavily in data and will be, I'm sure, discussed in the Judiciary Committee as well, but this being the committee, the health committee, it seems appropriate to ask the department to take a look to, under with existing funds, we make it clear in here, and the department says they can and would be willing to do that, would be for them to take a look at what the consulting with medical research and advocacy groups that we spell out in line 29 of the amendment, medical research data privacy experts and specialists in various types of medical care, medical genetics, as well as patient advocacy and data privacy groups, consult with them, reviewing newborn screening programs, evaluate the scientific and medical validity of the system we have for maintenance, storage, and long-term use, and so on, of this, figuring out how that fits in with our guidelines, and just report to us. The 71-day period is, maybe that's appropriate. The 2 years, maybe that is. There are clearly losses of use of data. I have a doctor from the University of Minnesota here to speak to it in just a minute as well. But so the first 5 or 6 lines of the bill would say that under the court ruling in November of 2011, from that point forward, they gathered up all the data and I believe the test results as well, the test samples as well, they have that under court jurisdiction right now. But everything since that time is under this. The agency voluntarily was complying with that by saying, we will destroy blood spots after 71 days. We'll keep the data for 2 years. That was the protocol that the department pulled out at the time. And so blood spots are being destroyed every 2 years. We're not trying to change that. But the test results, the data, not the genetic samples or anything, would start being destroyed this November 16th. And what we're saying is if we're asking the department to do an overview of the scientific approach and report back to us by next February, we're saying can we at least hold back on destroying those test results in November, hold them back for an extra 6 months so the legislature can look at it, see if they feel there's appropriate use or not. I've been trying to reach, as a courtesy, Representative Holberg, who worked in the department, has felt they've had good dealings with her. We've exchanged calls. But we have not connected yet. But I think that this is a rational and reasonable approach, not trying to undo anything with it here, but let's study it. And for those, in effect, it would be 5 or 6 months of data destruction, hold on to it for 6 months so the legislature can. And as you can see on lines 8 through 10 of the, or 7 through 10 of the amendment, page 1, a parent or legal guardian, again, we're giving it the same thing where right now, if your test results, again, this is not the blood spot itself, we're destroying that. But with those test results that they could continue, a parent or legal guardian could send in the thing asking it to be destroyed, it would not be subject to this extra extension if so. But I'm not trying to do any more than we need to have the legislature take a look at what the department would do. And so I think perhaps Mr. Koppel could speak to the fact that about doing this with the existing budget and so on. And then I would love to have witness come to testify, Sue Berry, who's the director of genetics and metabolism at the Department of Pediatrics at the U of M, ask her to come speak to this briefly as well.
Okay, thank you. On the amendment, is there anyone wishing in the audience to speak to the amendment?
I think Ms. Brace wants to speak, I'm sure, with concerns about it and the bill, but I also have Sue Berry from the U of M who would like to speak to the amendment specifically.
Is your preference, Senator Marty, that we take action on the amendment as a part of the bill or have testimony on the amendment itself?
Madam Chair, because the rest of the bill came from the Health Department, I think we should deal with the amendment separately and have testimony on it. I want the committee to know, make it real clear what I'm asking for and why, how the department and others feel about it. So.
Okay, then who would you like to have testify
maybe
first?
Mr. Koppel may wish to, I'm not trying to put him on the spot, but if he wants to speak to this about whether the department can handle it with the existing funds, whether they feel the language is appropriate or not, or what.
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll speak to the storage and use part of this amendment, which basically is asking us to come back, I believe February 1st, with a report on how, under existing law, we would move forward with a storage and use policy for the collection of blood spots and data. Again, what happened last year is we agreed under the law for program operations, et cetera, are very, very clear. What we left and said for a future time was to say that the storage of blood spots and data will be destroyed in set amount of time unless the parents consent to additional time for storage and use. We have never implemented that additional piece, the consent for storage and use, because that's quite an undertaking from where we were, which was they could opt out in the past. Now they have to opt in. So what we're basically coming back with in February would be, how do you set up a program where you can go in into working with physicians and with families to get that opt-in in order to store and use the data? So it's just a report on what we would propose, system that we would propose to do that. We would be able to do that without additional resources. There's already been a lot of thought given to that process because we are very interested in continuing to be able to store and use this data, very valuable data. It is Ironically, today we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of newborn screening in Minnesota. We have a premier program. It has gone from one test to 55 today. We're able to save hundreds of lives due to those tests, and they were developed through research and through this data. So we don't propose to change the law. We simply, within the law, how do we move forward and continue to collect and store data and continue to be able to move forward and save lives in the future with additional tests and refinements of current tests?
Thank you. Who else is asking to testify? Ms. Berry?
Dr. Berry?
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Berry.
Thank you. I'm actually a physician at the University of Minnesota.
Excuse me, Dr. Berry.
That's okay. It just gets confusing for people, and I want people to understand why I feel like this is something I can speak to. So I'm not usually a stickler for titles, but for this moment I will be. Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. As people have said, I'm Sue Berry. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I specialize in the care of babies identified by newborn blood spot screening. That's my life. That's what I do. I knew from my practice and from the families that I serve, some of whom some of you could have met today. They're really outstanding young people, about the power and the life-saving impact of newborn screening. And so I'm really happy to have the chance to speak to you today about what could be many people think of as a dry subject, which is data and the storage of data. It sounds like a box with dust over it. But it's not just that. Saving data about newborn screening results is absolutely critical. Its importance has really twofold impacts. It's important, critical, I would say, for public health and its promise, and it's essential for patient care and outcomes for the children that I take care of. It's newborn screening is really a process, not an event. It extends upon beyond just the simple performance of the test across the lifespan of the babies identified by the program as having a severe condition. It's absolutely necessary. And the only way you know what you've done is to save the information. If the information is destroyed, it's gone. We know testing saves lives, but there's no ultimate way to know if the value of newborn screening and its promise for improved outcomes has been achieved without longer-term follow-up. If you destroy data after 24 months, we simply will not be able to accomplish that. We'll never be able to know. And I feel that that's an important and difficult responsibility that we have in public health. It's necessary. I don't know of any other public health program that would destroy data that's essential to determining whether they've achieved the promise they had for public health. I find that, frankly, shocking. On a more personal level, and with regard to my practice, pediatricians are really concerned about the destruction of this data. We use it for patient care. And you say, well, just look at the patient's chart. Well, you're sitting in the emergency room. A kid comes in, 3 years old. He's in seizures, his blood acid levels are out the roof, you don't know what's going on. You say, could this be a metabolic condition? What did the kid's newborn screening say? So it's very common for us to call the Department of Health, and they have people on call even, to say, what was the result of this test? At age 3, if it's been destroyed after 2 years, we would never know, and we would have to start over with the assumption that that child had not been screened. We would not know their diagnosis. It would definitely impair our ability to immediately either set aside that line of investigation or tackle the problem immediately. So there are a lot of reasons why the data is critical, not only because public health is important, and I know that Mr. Koppel has really devoted a lot of time and effort to making sure that public health's promise can be achieved, but in terms of my promise to the families I have, it breaks my heart to think the data would be gone. And that's as simple as it can be.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berry. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's why I think it's important that we ask the department to look at it. And again, next year becomes, if they come up with a report and says, you know, in order to save all this stuff, it's going to cost this much money to do that, then we're going to have to decide, do we want to do that or find an alternative or let the data be destroyed? But I think that this is We're trying to be very narrow in terms of just saving the data, we're not extending the blood spot saving or anything like that. We're leaving the parents the opt-out during that, so they could opt out of that extra 6 months maximum. Only a few people would be 6 months. But I wanted to leave that with the committee as a thing, and I know Ms. Braze had concerns about the bill, and I'm sure about the amendment as well, and then I'm happy to stand for questions now or after that.
Did you want further testimony on this amendment at this time?
I think Ms. Braze will indicate she wanted to speak to the amendment as well.
To the amendment. Okay, Ms. Braze. While Ms. Braze is coming up, the proposal in the amendment is to continue to store the data while you prepare a proposal for how to deal with this because of the consent, right. An act of consent. Yeah, but I didn't get, are you saying just for 6 months?
Madam Chair, in other words, we're not trying to change the schedule with the 71 days for destroying the blood spot and 2 years for destroying the data. We're just saying...
Where does that take it? Get done with the 6 months
and 2 years?
At the
end
of
6 months, then they would just start destroying the data.
I'm trying to talk, Senator Marty, about whether or not the extension is enough time for the report to be prepared and for you to get back and move something through the legislature.
Madam Chair, I would love to do more than this. I'm trying to be as cautious and conservative about changing what's in there because I think the rest of the bill and everything else is important as well. And I figure if they report back to us, if the department issues a report next February 1st, we've got the rest of session to try and do something. If not, the data would be destroyed. But as of without this legislation, it's going to be destroyed beginning in November anyway.
I see. Okay.
So it gives us a chance, Madam Chair. It doesn't say anything's going to change. It gives us
a
chance.
No, I understand that. I just want to make sure that the time that you've established in here allows, should it pass, is that it allows for the legislature to have time to act on the recommendations next year. And the answer to that is yes.
Madam Chair, as you know, yes, it gives us a chance to do it. My personal belief is, you know, if we leave people the opt-out we had in the past, we should be able to... Of the 70,000 kids a year, if there were 100 opting out, you know, hey, they should be able to make sure their kids, not only the blood spots, but the data and everything else is destroyed. But, you know, when my kids were that age, I would have wanted the pediatrician to be able to call the department and have it available. And for the fact that it might do research to help other kids benefit, I think so. I understand there are people who feel very strongly about this, trying to be sensitive to that and just... do the minimum we can so the legislature has another chance to review it.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Braze.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And this is the first that I have seen this amendment, and although I have talked to Senator Marty about my concerns about the bill in general, but I am concerned about this amendment because we worked so very hard last session to figure out this language in a way that was amenable. You may or may not know the history of this issue, but we discovered that the department was keeping the blood results. We discovered that in 2003. They had been keeping them since July 1st of 1986. So the test results had been there for a very long time. By the time we realized that they were keeping them, there was no law allowing them to keep them. There was only a law allowing them to keep a registry of those who had who actually had conditions discovered, not everybody who had been tested. So when I look at this, I feel like it just gives the department, even though Senator Marty says it's not coming from the department, it is something that does give the department more wiggle room to try and get beyond what we had achieved through the lawsuit that parents brought and made it through the Supreme Court and was ruled in favor of the parents on November 16th, 2011. And so we don't support giving them that space of time. 6 months also, just to be clear, would be, I believe, May 11th, 2014 rather than June 1st. I think this is meant just for to the end of the legislative session of next year. And my concern is that, as always, when a parent is having a child, it's a very difficult time. It's frenetic, it's frantic, it's fuzzy. That's how it's been described. And this once again moves to that their test results will be saved unless they provide a signed and dated form requesting destruction. Well, I just know from the history of this issue that parents don't even know this is happening. They don't know how to get a form if they did know it was happening. A lot of times the staff doesn't know. And it becomes an extra burden on them to do something to protect the privacy of their children. And when you look into the future, I mean, I know that 6 months is being talked here, but I look into the future of this issue, and I know that there are people who want, professionals who want to genomically sequence every child, so that this does not just become a test result, it becomes the entire DNA sequence, the entire genomic profile. And I don't care to give, our organization doesn't care to give 6 more months for them to have more, one more legislative session to try and undo what we did last year. So we are indeed concerned and do not support the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the amendment? Are there any questions or further discussion from committee members? Senator Newman. Or Nino, excuse me.
That's okay. I've been called worse, Madam Chair.
No, no. I'm sorry. It's my brain is fried.
I'm sorry I kept you up so late, Madam Chair.
Yes, you did, and I intend to hold you accountable.
I had similar sentiments to what Twyla Brace, or Ms. Brace, just vocalized. When this came to light a few years ago, I was, I don't know the right word, displeased is maybe too weak, disconcerted maybe is a little too strong. But I realized that the department, without any notification, certainly without any permission, was maintaining genetic material and processing testing on all of my children. I was not happy about that. In fact, I was not a part of the lawsuit, but I was involved in some of the preliminary activity in contacting the department and asking them what they had done with my children's material, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is the department, per the Minnesota courts, was acting illegally. They broke the law. They took and retained something that they did not have permission to have. Where I come from, that's called theft. And the gentleman at the table previously testified that it's very valuable. You know, at some point, if you're stealing things and it reaches a certain point of value, it becomes a felony. So if you want to put it in that context, we're talking about serious activity here. Now, there's certainly plenty of good things that they've done with this material and testing that they've done illegally, material that they've taken in violation of the law, testing that they've done on material that they took illegally. Does that then make them benevolent thieves? It's just a very, very problematic scenario. And despite all the good things that they talk about could be done, much of that could have been done permissively, maybe most of it, but none of it was. And that's a problem. And in my opinion anyway, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee might disagree with me, but we are here primarily to represent individual citizens and representatives, or excuse me, and residents of Minnesota. We're not here to, certainly not represent the department. We're not here to promote advancement at the expense of individuals and their children and their privacy. So I although I find the approach reasonable, Senator Marty, I find the goal unreasonable in that the courts made a decision and said, stop it, destroy this, get rid of this material and the data and all of that. And now we're trying to go back and say, well, yeah, we lost in the courts, but it's so good, we really should do it. Just never mind the fact that we broke the law and stole material and tested it from your children. And I just find that really, really, really problematic. And maybe that's enough of a soliloquy, and I'll leave it there. I don't think I can support the amendment, and we'll see about the rest of the bill. I'm not sure yet.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as a nurse, I come from a different perspective. I'm grateful that we were thoughtful enough to keep this data and that it has helped so many children. Sometimes I think it takes us a while, as we're finding with the new data on the internet and so on, that it takes a while for our laws to catch up with science. This is an issue where somebody was smart enough or whatever, had the thought to keep track of this information so that it could be used to help other children. And I am personally appalled at the idea of destroying it. So I don't think any harm was done by keeping it. I don't think there's any intent to harm anybody. And in fact, the intent is to improve the health care of our children. So I am strongly in support of this.
Senator Nino.
Madam President, there's some very, very smart and thoughtful thieves in this world. And they have a lot of foresight and a lot of forethought. But they're still thieves, and it's still wrong what they do. And I can tell you that harm was done because my family's involved. And we were bothered. Our privacy was invaded. Our personal material was taken without permission. That is an invasion of privacy and infringement on liberty, and it's wrong. Now, if we want to change the law at a point in time going forward, we can do that, and then everyone knows what the rules are, at least theoretically. If the department thought this was so important, and they have very, very smart people there that can read the statutes, and they could see that there was no legal authority given to them, they could have and should have come to this legislative body back in the 80s or whenever and said, you know, we can do really, really good things. We're really thoughtful people, and we can look forward into the future and see all the great tests that we can do. And they should have asked permission, at least legislative permission. Now, the legislature could have said, we don't need parental notification. They can just do it. The public could have come here and testified on a bill that said that, said it's a good idea, bad idea. But we would have had an open and thorough and legitimate process. And if that's what the law was, then everybody would have known what the rules were. And if someone really had a problem with that, they could have gone to Wisconsin, or they could have had a home birth, but they would have known what the rules were. But that was not the rule. That was not the law. And we need to operate under the rule of law. And the department operated outside the law. The court said that. And that's wrong. And just because now there's the potential for this benefit from the existing data set doesn't mean that we should just say, oh, well, what they did doesn't matter. There's no repercussion. If it's that valuable, the department can go back and ask permission. Right now, we've given permission to parents to opt into destruction. Let's ask them to opt out of destruction. I could support that approach, but that's not what we're doing. We're once again hoping that those parents whose children were infringed upon are just not going to notice, not going to send in the form, and they're probably not. And I think if the department were to come up and I were to ask them why not have the opt-in to retaining the material, they would say, well, nobody would do it. Why? Because they wouldn't know how. Well, exactly. That's why they opt out, because nobody will do it, because they don't know how. I just find it highly problematic.
I just have to get some clarification because Senator Nino is talking. I'm afraid I misunderstood the bill.
I'm speaking to the amendment, madam.
Or the amendment. The amendment. Thank you. And the intent of this amendment is not to change the opt-in or opt-out. It is to delay the implementation of it so that you can design a plan to implement the requirement that the parent must opt in. and therefore increase or improve a process that would allow the storage of data longer under the expectations that were communicated in the court. Am I correct in understanding
that? Yes, you're exactly correct. We are not changing any of this presumption. We're not even changing the time period for the blood spots, but those are being destroyed every day as the 71-day period comes up. So somebody born 72 days ago, they're destroying them, or 71 days after the department receives them, which I don't know, may take several weeks. But 71 days, we're not changing that for the two-year one. We're just delaying. We're not removing the two-year savings clause. We're just saying after we want to let the department report back to us if they can come up with a way on how to do it, to study this, and I think that's appropriate. And the other thing I wanted to say real briefly, and that is that, Senator Nino, you have the right to characterize it as theft, even good intention theft. I'd point it out, another one is also a parent of kids, that you know, I want that, even if it's only a chance in 10,000 that blood spot and data from that and everything else can help my kids, even if there's only a chance in 100 that it's going to help some other kids, I want that to be saved. And under what's going on now, it's being destroyed whether I want it or not, because they're not, because the courts have got the old stuff now. But let's just wait and figure out what makes sense from this. If the department can figure out a way to do this, make them make recommendations. All we're doing is postponing the destruction for, as Ms. Bray pointed out, 6.5 months or 7 months, so we can get through a legislative session and consider.
And Senator Marty, part of what is being said, I think, and Senator Nino can make his own points, but is a concern or a fear that is inherent in this request, even though it's not creating a change of this opt-in, opt-out, that underneath this is a goal to change that. And you're saying that
Madam
there
Chair,
may or may not be. I have
right.
any idea, but it's not what's in this.
Madam
this
Chair, I personally think that the decision to destroy all this and the court's ruling isn't that it was bad to save it. It's that the state didn't have the statutory authority, the specific statutory authority. They were relying on a general authority and so on. I'm not trying to, the courts, you know, maybe the courts really want it destroyed. I don't know that they do. I think they are feeling the department didn't have the authority the department thought it had. The department came forward several years ago trying to get that authority, did not pass. The court decision said, okay, everything from this point on, and the department worked out the 71 days with the court. That's what they and Representative Holberg worked out as legislation. All I'm saying is, can't we at least ask the department to spend a little less than a year, take a look at how you do it? Can they come up, maybe working with the U of M, of a way to store it and figure out who wants it saved and who doesn't want it saved before we destroy it? Because you can't get it back once it's destroyed. And I think
that Senator Marty, that the bill clearly speaks to extending some time in order to work out some of the kinks in the process before that will result in data being destroyed that you may not have to destroy if you could work out a system. I think Senator Nienau and Ms. Brace have communicated that they don't want to do the extension. The ruling was in place. The opportunity to resolve those issues has been there. And this really concerns them as a move to sort of undo what's been resolved. So I think that's, you know, the vote here will be about what of those perspectives you're going to support. Senator Nienau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you and Senator Morney trying to clarify, but you were clarifying something I wasn't talking about.
Okay.
I was talking about lines 1.7 and 1.8 on the amendment, where a parent can sign a form requesting destruction of the test results. That's an opt-out of the saving. And the reason that's an opt-out is because no parent is going to do that. They're not going to even know it's available, very few, are even going to know it's available. And to comply with the spirit of the previous law and to comply with the spirit of the court ruling, that should be turned around and the schedule should be retained. Unless a parent says, you know what, I'd like to keep them in, like Senator Marty said, he'd like to keep it in. I would be perfectly fine with that. I would not have a problem with that at all. But in my opinion, this has it backwards, and that's what I was talking about.
Okay, thank you. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that you were right about the interpretation that you had, and to those very lines with the opt out. You're able to opt out of the extension. So I think what Senator Marty is saying is that we'll try to extend this time period for the Department of Health to get an opt in that will survive for periods beyond this postponement. But if you're uncomfortable with the postponement at all, you can let them know that you're uncomfortable with the postponement. To switch this around right here would yield no postponement at all and would just take out the postponement. So, I mean, I think you're just saying that you're opposed to the entirety of the amendment, and that's fine. But I think that the clarification that Madam Chair gave was accurate. And so if you were to switch that to an opt-in, then it would still be same thing as current law, and the amendment would have no purpose in the way that I read it.
Follow-up, Senator.
Well, Senator Lurie, if we turned it around, and I'm not proposing an amendment, if we turned it around, absolutely we would have a postponement, but we would have a postponement only for those who wanted it.
But we wouldn't, no. Madam Chair.
It's confusing but, language in a way because it does the opposite, we think,
we
of
wouldn't
what you're
need,
saying.
If the whole point of the postponement is that people aren't going to be able to the Department of Health isn't going to be able to get a system up in time for people to communicate with them in the first place. And so if you have to destroy, unless people are contact you and say they don't want you to destroy in order for them to postpone, to build the system so that they can inform you that they don't want you to destroy, it really doesn't work. I mean, it's totally redundant at that point.
Let me give it
redundant,
a try, too.
Yes.
That this language on 1.17 and 1.18 relates to, it only has importance in the context of the request, which is to extend the failure to destroy data, and allows in this time frame, in this specific instance, for any parent who may be like Senator Nienau that doesn't want that extension can opt out of it. It's not related to the overall opt-in, opt-out issues that we've dealt with in this whole last year.
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. Can I I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to say I came in with the amendment without that in there, and I shared this with the Health Department yesterday, and they said, well, you know, you might make people feel more comfortable if somebody who objects to that 6-month savings could opt out. So I put it in, and now that's obviously confusing people. I'm happy to take that language out of it. But the whole point of it was just to say, let's just keep it for 6 months extra so we can let the department.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace has been patiently waiting to speak here. And then Senator Hayden and then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just several things. I just want to be clear about what the lawsuit was. It was not just about the fact that they had been keeping all of this without any statutory authority. It was also that it was a violation of the genetic privacy law, which required them to get consent for collection, storage, use, and dissemination. And they refused, despite being told this by an ALJ, by an administrative law judge. They refused to get the consent. So several things. One is what this language does is for 7 months or about, 35,000 to 40,000 children, they are not protected by the law as it stands today. This is an exemption from the law as it stands today because today it gets destroyed. They don't have to think about it. They don't have to know about it. You know, we had the opt-out in law in 2003 after we discovered it. It was put in. But parents weren't told. Parents don't know. Hospitals didn't know. Opt-out puts the burden on parents who have just had a brand-new baby to know what's going on. This is 6 months, 7 months of children not being protected, half of the, population of the state that gets born every year. And getting consent is as simple as creating a consent form and putting it in the rules and saying the hospitals have to make it available. It's that simple.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Senator Hayden?
Well, yeah, just briefly, Madam Chair. I mean, this is, I,
I hesitate to get involved in this because I know it conjures up deep emotions for all of us on some level. And so I'm always a little concerned with our language and making sure that we're keeping it at a level that all of us don't get too emotional. But with that being said, I was thinking about talking to Mr. Capo about how does this play out in a practical way. And I know Ms. Braze kind of was getting there at the end of her testimony, because I think we talk about this stuff at a high level, but you know, Senator Nenow said, well, most people wouldn't do it, and then Senator Marty said, well, maybe they would, and Senator Lori said, well, they wouldn't. What really happens? And so how would a parent know to opt out? Or conversely, if we changed it, how would they know to opt in? So the child said, you have your child. Right,
Mr. Koppel.
What happens,
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what is relevant to this bill and what we're talking about today? I believe what was being proposed is.
You're talking about the amendment now? That's the focus of this discussion.
So what is being proposed is that we come back next year with a plan on how to store and use data and blood spots in the future. And it would have to, our plan would reflect current law, which is the 71-day destruction of blood spots and the 2-year destruction of data, unless there's consent for longer storage and use or an opt-in. So what we are asking in this amendment would be to come back with a plan to do that. For instance, in Michigan, there's an initiative with the state of Michigan, a consent-based initiative, where with the University of Michigan, they have set up a bank where they approach through the physicians, treating the pediatricians, as well as directly with parents, where they ask for consent. They get about 65% of the blood spots data for storage and use. That would be one way to proceed as an example of a way to operate under the law that Senator Nenow, I think, is concerned about, but at the same time move forward with the ability to store and use, whether it be a research or a refinement of current tests, whatever that might be, but only with the consent of the parents. That's what we would, I believe Senator Marty's asking us to bring back next year, are ways to do that within the law.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's all relevant to something that was started in 2004. The Maternal Child Health Bureau and HRSA created the region, 7 regional genetic information centers throughout the United States. Minnesota was part of Region 4, and it's amazing that our testimony brings up Michigan, because Michigan was part of that. Dr. Berry was part of that discussion early on. There is so much data collected from all those universities that have germaneness to what we're talking about right here, and I think it makes sense to extend this because the 4 outcomes that were decision-making, screening cutoffs was one, diagnosis, the long-term treatment and care for genetic disorders within youth and families, and everything from transition on. I mean, it was rich conversation back then and still to this day. So I think because another thing it added to, Madam Chair, was there was forms for families, decision makers, and there was models for improvement all around medical home. And in Minnesota, we know what medical home is. So I think the synergy is there for us to get this moving to where there's discussion, because the research is out there and there's some good best practices out there. And I'm happy you brought up Michigan, because I think that's a model that we could adopt right here in Minnesota. So I think this amendment is worthy of its own and should move forward, Madam Chair.
Okay, so let's take action on the amendment, and then we can get to the bill. Senator Marty renews his motion to approve the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment passes. On the bill. Any discussion on the bill?
Flair.
It's the time for... you didn't have a chance to speak to the bill, Ms. Brace. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we look at this bill after having spent the entire time from or having spent 2003 to 2009 before we got to a lawsuit. Nine parents sued the department for the retention, storage, use, et cetera, of their DNA. And so I just want us all to remember, or you all to know, maybe is the best way to say it, why the bill is here. So in 2003, our organization discovered the warehousing of baby DNA. The storage, use, and dissemination of baby DNA was being done without legislative authority. It took 6 years to get a lawsuit and nearly 3 years for nine families to win that lawsuit in the Minnesota Supreme Court. This bill will protect the department from lawsuits for all other unauthorized collection, storage, use, and sharing activities that we've never even heard about because they aren't in statute. They claim they are doing these activities under the general authority of the department, but if that's true, why do you pass laws that give them specific authority if their general authority is legal authority to do it anyway? They have been acting for years as if they don't need your permission for whatever they want to do with our genetic information and personal health records. But now that they have been sued and found in the wrong, they would like perpetual protection for these activities which aren't in the statute and we don't even know about. So we have no idea how many collections, uses, research, databases, and registries they have that are not specified in state law. They were going to bring a report about that. I was in the meeting with Representative Holberg. They were going to bring a report that was part of getting out of jail free for 1 year. We've never seen that report. The newborn screening database was keeping genetic test results since 1986 without any statutory authority. The only authority in law was for a registry of positive test results, and the lawsuit forced them to get consent. This bill would authorize the department to not only continue to collect, store, and disseminate blood and tissues and other biological specimens of citizens without fear of a lawsuit. It would allow them to collect, store, use, and disseminate all sorts of health and medical data without fear of a lawsuit. So it's good to look at what the bill actually says. So the definition of health data on line 2.10, which is not actually detailed in the bill, is quite broad. Health data under Chapter 13 is data on individuals created, collected, received, or maintained by the Department of Health, political subdivisions, or statewide systems relating to the identification, description, prevention, and control of disease, or as part of an epidemiological investigation the commissioner designates as necessary to analyze, describe, or protect the public health. So this would appear to include all the electronic medical records in the state health information exchange. Use and sharing of health data is authorized in lines 2.21, line 3.16, line 3.26, line 4.4, line 4.8, and line 4.21. In addition to that, line 3.23 adds health data to the definition of genetic information in a section of law separate from the State Genetic Privacy Act, causing a conflict in statute that could be used to neutralize our genetic privacy law. There are also many undefined broad terms, such as on line 3.1, where biological specimens are blood, urine, whatever, and health data can be used to monitor the health status of a population. And line 3.8, where it can be used for conducting other activities necessary to protect or improve the health of individuals and populations for which biological specimens or health data are necessary. Well, these are very broad. Who decides what other activities these are and when it is necessary? On line 3.12, the bill limits the definition of research, exempting research taking place under the department's program operations from the definition. On line 4.3 to 4.6, the commissioner can use the specimens and medical records without consent for federally approved research, which allows researchers to use specimens that have the individual's identities linked with a code. Keep in mind that all DNA is identifiable. So if you pass this bill, you will, first of all, have no idea what you are authorizing because the department has not revealed, despite their promise to do so, they have not revealed all the data and tissues that it already collects and is collecting without legislative authority, all the situations under which it's doing this collecting, including of health data, or how it has been shared or used in the past. This is a get-out-of-jail-forever-free.
bill, and we oppose it. And I'm going to just pass this out because I think perhaps some of you don't have any idea, just some of the databases that are available. But here we have the birth, death, marriage, adoption, the vital statistics, the birth defects information system, the cancer surveillance system, the diabetes surveillance system, the HIV, AIDS. We still have the DNA repository that's hanging around. You can take that. Thank you. The genetic registry, which is the test results that they're trying now to keep for a longer period of time, the sexually transmitted diseases, the stroke registry, the trauma registry, the immunization information connection. And I would just guess that we have other ones that aren't in statute. We just haven't heard about, because that is what we have discovered through the baby DNA issue. So obviously we oppose this bill, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Breeze.
Thank you.
All right, on the bill, any discussion? Seeing none, Senator Marty renews his motion to pass Senate File 1017 and refer it to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes and the bill is referred to Judiciary. It appears that there is not any more business before our committee, so the meeting shall adjourn. And thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.